Hello, Rachel.
Hello, Ryan.
How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm feeling yum yum. Dare I say I need a Jovian sunspot to really quench my thirst of yum yum. That's how I'm doing currently. How about yourself?
I'm good.
Not yum yum?
Nah.
Well, that's
not
a bummer.
Not just yet. I may be feeling more yum yum after we introduce our guests.
Yes, we have some guests and we'll get to them in a second, but we've got the big things to break down first, which is we are talking about Babylon 5 one episode at a time from a rewatch perspective, which does mean full-on spoilers. If you have not seen the show, watch the show, come back to us. You've been told. But before we introduce the guests that are credited in the title of this episode, which kind of takes the sting out of it, I want to talk about Yum Yum and how it's important. We named our show Yum Yum because of the iconic line, the sexual line, the invigorating line, the spiritual line, the motivating line from Star Trek.
A pivotal point in our personal histories.
It was the dawn of the third age of mankind, that line. And I want to talk about who in this particular episode of Babylon 5 most likely to have said Yum Yum if it was written by the Star Trek Discovery writers. Mm-hmm. Who is your candidate for the Yum Yum?
Deathwalker.
J'Adore?
Herself.
She's good. My candidate is Mr. Abbott, especially in reference mm-hmm. to his foods and drinks, but I have a bold candidate, a wild horse, I would say, which is Mr. Garibaldi had some yum yum mm-hmm. energy because he called Natoth sister rather sassily out of nowhere. He's like, listen here, sister, and I almost came in my pants hearing that. So
you creamed your jeans.
I creamed my jeans. But to help cream our jeans, we are joined by our good friends over at Chats a Television Podcast. Hi, guys.
Hello. Yeah. Sorry, I watched a bunch of wrestling last weekend, so all I know how to do now is do entrances. And then there's like an 80s pop song and like explosions and pyro. Hi, everybody. It's Alan and Magellan from Chats a Television Podcast, the number two TV discussion podcast this side of the Uncharted Territories. I'm Alan. That's Magellan giggling over there. Tell them what's your story, bud.
Yeah. Tell us your story, Magellan.
Well, it all started in 1993. We're from a TV podcast. We're watching TV right now. We're watching Twin Peaks. We watched Babylon 5 a while ago, and we're so excited to be here, talk about it again.
Yeah, you guys cover a wide array of television shows. You've done quite the gambit. And before, we've had Alan on the show before, so some people who listen to that episode may be familiar, but you guys have done like a numerous amount of things quality-wise, whether it be good or bad or in the middle. You've done it, basically. Although you haven't done V, the original V, just saying, could
True.
Do that. I mean,
True.
It has Deathwalker in it.
Tonight is your chance to see how it all began, to relive the excitement that is V, the most extraordinary miniseries ever.
Tell us a bit about your relationship and history with Babylon 5 as a whole.
So our first season of the podcast was about our coverage. It was our coverage of Farscape, another cult classic sci-fi television show. We loved it very much and all of its wacky characters and puppets.
Australian classic.
Exactly, Australian cultural product. And we wanted a follow-up sci-fi show that was obscure but had a passionate fan base. And, you know, we tested out a lot of different shows, and we ended up landing on Babylon 5, even though it seemed a bit too serious at the time, but just from, like, reading about it. But, boy, howdy, did we end up enjoying not only its wackier moments, but the parts where it becomes a really poignant, interesting, you know, sci-fi allegory for the destructive nature of fascism.
Mm-hmm. One of its allegories it explores.
Yeah.
And I think it was, you know, in between Farscape and Babylon 5, there were like a couple years of us doing other shows. And for both of, we've sort of like felt that our heart is really in these cult classic space shows that should be talked about more, because those are like the kind of turning point moments for us. And we like launched our Patreon during Chatslon 5, and our listenership, you know, expanded to include people like yourself, Ryan, and some other really great listeners that have carried through since then. So we not only love the show, but also like are grateful to it for that like kind of moment of growth for us. And you know, I like that our show is able to capture the first watch experience because Babylon 5 is like such a special first watch to experience. And I'm just going to get out ahead of this and say, that said, our first watch of Deathwalker, we were unimpressed by the episode.
Yeah.
And it is interesting to return to this episode with the context of having seen the whole show.
Yeah.
And I think more importantly, with the sense of like trust in Babylon 5 as a story, because like,
you know, they don't fuck you over.
Yeah. Right. Cause like or waste your time with like filler. Cause a show like Farscape or I don't know, the show that we first watched in this way together, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, like there's a lot of stupid episodes that are just stupid and
don't follow V5 the theme of the show overall.
It's interesting that you can still say that even though the subplot of this episode does end up not coming to full fruition because of changes that happened in the background, but there's still enough trust and there's still enough good in that on its own.
Well,
it's just fine.
We'll talk about our histories in a second, but I would love for Magellan, if you could please read for us all, so everyone's up to date listening, the DVD summary of Deathwalker. I'm very keen to hear season 1, episode 9's summary according to the DVD.
All right, here we go. Extradite her for trial. Better yet, some say kill her on the spot. Passions run high with the arrival of the war criminal known as Deathwalker. She's biochemist. That's an interesting noun to choose. She's biochemist Jadur, played by Sarah Douglas, whose discovery of an immortality potion came via sadistic experimentation of Narns and other aliens.
That is Deathwalker, people. Let's give a rundown of our history and relationship with this particular episode and a brief what we think of it now. Rachel, what was your relationship with Deathwalker first seeing it, and how do you feel about it now?
I remember being a little bit underwhelmed. I was like, this feels like a small but important story in the journey of the first season, and just thinking, why the fuck is this Talia story here? Which I still wonder, but
well,
like,
there's
I know
an answer to that.
Yeah, there's an answer, but it doesn't feel good.
Well, understanding's a three-edged sword.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
But what do you think? What do you think about it now?
I think it's great. It sets up so many things, but it does stand pretty well on its own. But there is a level of appreciation that you just can't get for this episode on the first viewing.
So, Alan, what about you? What's been your relationship with this episode, and how do you feel about it, revisiting it?
Well, of course, it's hard to return to a series that you've already seen before and reevaluate it. But I agree with Rachel, actually, that that specific plot line, the Talia one, confused me at the time. And now, even knowing where the Vorlon stuff goes, it's a really big ask to have your audience believe, yeah, this thing is going to seem like nonsense now, but just put it in the back of your head and don't worry about it. Because I'm watching, let's imagine I'm watching this show week to week and I've never seen it. And I see that plot line where this guy with a weird brain thing is putting visions into her head, and this guy that paid her to do, you know, to be the mediator between them is not trolling her, but kind of like testing her for something we don't even get to know about for a long time.
Yeah.
That's difficult for me. And
thankfully, you're watching Twin Peaks currently, which doesn't do anything like that.
Oh, especially
all,
in the second
Ryan,
season.
At all.
Second
yes,
season
is second...
so clear.
It's not like you have to wait 25 years.
No.
No. My other thing, though, about this episode in general is the Jadur plot line, I think, can also rub you the wrong way if you aren't sure what the like stakes in Babylon 5 are. Because the idea of an immortality serum seems overpowered and broken in that sci-fi way. But I actually think that it's handled fairly well, and it really brings stakes to like, oh, when something hits Babylon 5, they have jurisdiction over where it goes. They get to, it's on the shoulders of Sinclair to decide, hey, does this go to the Earth, or does this go to us, or does this go to whoever? Like, it's immediate stakes in a way that you can't really get to in season one otherwise without ratcheting up, like, this is literally immortality.
Yeah, and Magellan, you already kind of commented, but I also did choose you two specifically because of how kind of underwhelmed and dismissive you were of this episode upon the initial watch. Could you kind of touch upon what that was about for you in your recollection? And has that changed much at all? Like, how do you think about this episode now?
I think Rachel's point is really at the core of how I feel about this episode, that like our initial viewing, we were underwhelmed and, like you said, dismissive and called the episode filler. We were a little harsh, and our discussion of it was pretty short. It was like a 20-something minute discussion, which for us is a little out of the ordinary. Certainly not what we do now. And I think, you know, I just, as like a critique of myself, sometimes get caught up, especially when I'm new to a show like this, in the particulars of like rules. Like what Alan was speaking to, the rules of the world, right? And feeling like this you just introduced this thing that now kind of throws off my understanding of the balance of things and what's possible in Babylon 5, and like I'm annoyed by that. And I think I think that is annoying, and I think that this episode is a little opaque in certain ways to people who are watching it for the first time. And on rewatching it, I don't think my opinion in that sense has changed. Like, I'm not here to say this is a good episode, actually, and I was wrong, but rather to say, like, there is a lot to appreciate here about just, like, the consistency of Babylon 5 and the ways that, like, characters in this episode are on a part of their journey that makes sense. Like, Sinclair is making a big character choice that makes a lot of sense. Jakar's plot echoes and like rhymes with his larger arc, and like this concept of vengeance and the place of vengeance. And even Kosh, like that moment at the end where the Vorlons blow up the Death Walker, and we were like, that's stupid. Like, it is, but also the Vorlons placing themselves in the position to say, like, you don't get to do this yet, is very Vorlon-y in a way that when you watch the whole show, you appreciate it. So
also, they, like, literally explain themselves there. Like, I don't know how you can come out of that. Like, why did the Vorlons do that? It's like, we determined that you guys aren't ready for immortality. And even if you don't know that the Vorlons, like, controlled humanity's, like, fate or whatever, you still know that, like, this alien race has power we don't understand, and they get to make decisions like that. Done. It's explained in this episode. It's not even, like, this will make more. It will be fleshed out in detail down the line, but the exoskeleton of that concept is in this episode.
Yeah, it echoes an ideology that we don't know they have fully. Like, we understand, when you watch it initially, you just go, they're just mysterious, powerful beings that are pricks. And that's kind of it. Like, the whole episode, Kosh is a prick.
Yeah.
My history with this episode is, like I've said, I've been stuck, when I watched this initially, I was stuck with season one by itself for 3 years. So I've always...
You're sticking with that number this time?
3 or 4 years. Let's say 7. So I always kind of liked this episode as it's hammering in this sad aspect of Babylon 5 that distinguishes itself differently from other science fiction properties at the time, obviously Star Trek, which is failure. It was like, oh, this is nice that the heroes, no matter how much they try, things fail and they don't succeed, and the system's against them, even though they're a part of the system. And I always liked that. I always liked the obvious, to me, very obvious commentary about the weird dynamic that America has and had had, and other countries of co-opting Nazis and just, you know, the enemy and their scientists, engineers, and so on to benefit themselves, yet still walk around with this moral superiority. Like, we're better. Like, we're better than those evil Nazis who helped us go to the moon. I really do have to say this. It's sad I have to say this. I like the fact that J'adore is not sympathetic or relatable. She is a fascist and she's evil. It's as simple as that. There is no stroking your chin and theorizing, well, maybe the Dilgar had a point about the genocides, unlike Star Trek Discovery, who would make her a quipping character that you go, oh, this Nazi.
When we get the reveal that she's wearing her Dilgar uniform.
Proudly, too.
Like she's making a point.
Yeah, she's been revealed to be the war criminal to everyone, and now she wears the uniform.
And she's so proud of who she is.
And what she's done.
Mm.
And it's sad I have to state that, but in the current landscape of Star Trek, for instance, they applaud that for some reason, and I don't know why. So that is something on the rewatch that I enjoy.
I prefer a little totalitarian efficiency, but that's me.
I had a thought about Jadur. If I can introduce this to the chat?
If you're allowed to yes.
The chat.
You're allowed to, Alan.
Thank you, Slowinski. So she says, there's a point at the end where Sinclair is like, why do you get to decide, you know, what to do with the immortality? And like, don't we deserve this or whatever? And she like spits back at him like, humans don't. She basically says what Kosh may turns into action. Which is like, you guys don't get to pretend you're any better than people who do a genocide and then just move on from it. Humans have been doing that since the very beginning. And for you to say, like, you deserve this power and other people don't, is denying people the same way that we did to the Dilgar. And I think that JMS and company really understand that in order to make a villain interesting, you have to have them reflect something back at the protagonist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a lot of season one is about people like, you know, Sinclair coming to things with a moral high ground and then villains saying, well, actually, you didn't really think about this. And before we really tear that idea down in later seasons.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think what it foretells is a lot of the like most heinous choices that characters make in Babylon 5 are choices that that are like trade-offs of like, OK, I'm going to do this terrible thing because I believe it's for the benefit of my people or something like that. And she's making the point that, yeah, that's what you're going to do. You're going to look at this immortality thing and say it's okay to kill others because it'll bring you immortality. Jakar briefly considers it with Natoth's life at one moment. And that is for as kind of like throwaway as the immortality serum thing is, that core question of what depths are you willing to stoop in order to serve your goals or accomplish the things you want to accomplish? That's a thing that shows up again and again in Babylon 5. And it's like one of the core questions that characters have to grapple with and ultimately either arrive at like good answers or damning answers, depending on if you're Jakar or Londo.
I think one of the recurring statements of belief the characters have too is they believe they have no choice. And the fact that they think they have no choice actually is a choice being made to abstain, which further makes consequences. I think it's interesting that the two most morally upright people, one of which is because they're apathetic and the other one is because they're outspoken, is the apathy of Londo in this episode kind of makes him feel like morally upright in comparison to the rest. And the genuine concern that Garibaldi bestows in the episode, like he's the only, like he's really the major one that's just like, this is fucked up.
Yeah, he's like, there's no choice between justice and immortality, people.
I'm a cop, by the way. Of course I'm choosing justice. But like, I think it's interesting, like Sinclair, he bestows these values, but then by the end, he's disgusted by the reveal, but he has to follow orders. It's bigger than them. That's a choice being made of, well, I can't do much about this. I'll do what I can. But what he wants to do still is to abide by her and to tempt everyone else to allow her to do the things, which is, again, he's our morally upright commander. Yet he feels he has no other choices available to him. And the constructs of the universe of Babylon 5 in season 1 and in this episode reaffirms that belief system. Earth is against him. Everyone in the council is against him, including his good pal Lanier is against him. He's optimistic to think that the system will help him out, and it doesn't. And that's what makes him a great character, because he's optimistic to a sad point of being naive.
And he also thinks that, well, like, people are going to stick to their convictions.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
We know these people are like this, and we know the Minbari are honorable. Like that. And he gets burned.
Yeah, and he just sits at the end of the episode being like, fuck, man, is it always going to be like this? Is it always going to be like this?
I think in Sinclair's defense, though, like, he's not just a sort of victim of the way the system is, and he's like, meh, well, what are you going to do? He makes a very deliberate choice with regard to how he interacts with the non-aligned worlds, where in the council meeting, they say, dude, this is not, why does this work this way? Why do you five get to make this vote? The alien woman says the line is, what does she say? Da-da-da. Will no longer be dictated to by the very powers who aided this woman's atrocities. And Sinclair's response is like, sorry, them's the rules.
Yeah.
But then he decides, you know what? Actually, I'm going to realize that, like, there is a choice to be made and make the choice to, like, broker a separate deal. And even though the Vorlons blow her out of the sky, I think Sinclair leaves this episode with, like, a moral victory. He's chosen truly to be a diplomat
it's a concession
student.
Still, because at the end of it, his choice is to still benefit off the spoils of her war. He is still choosing that, but he thinks they'll arrest her after it's done, which she spits in the face of that notion. Deathwalker herself, she's like, that won't happen. And you know it won't, but you can try. And so that's why when I watch the scene at the end of the bar where he's just like, fuck, does this ever change? You at least have Garibaldi there to be his good friend who's like, well, there's at least people like you who's in the world, and that is something. That is something. And that's what, again, makes him the protagonist. That makes what makes him one of the more morally upright characters. But he is still trapped in the system that is the corrupt Earth government, as we know it to be. And it's one of those things where on a rewatch, you really go, oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't give a shit, do they?
Deathwalker is long dead, Commander. This is a priority order.
Without more information, I can't...
Commander St. Clair, all information in this matter is on a need-to-know basis, and you do not need to know. Have a pleasant day.
This is what I love about a B5 episode, is you're presented with the sci-fi plot of the week. Here's the plot.
Mm-hmm.
Immortality for everyone. And then
by the end of the year.
By the end of the year. And you're like, okay, if this was Star Trek, they'd have moral and ethical debates about it and blah, blah, blah. But as always is the case, instead, it spirals out of control into a political fiasco.
Yeah.
And diplomacy's being thrown around. And it goes to the point in which you forget. It's swept under the rug that the initial setup of this episode was Natoth, someone whose family is a victim of this genocidal maniac, attack this woman because she wanted just justice. That spirals out into a full political fiasco in which ships are being sent to Babylon 5 to destroy it because they aren't handing over this war criminal. And I love that that is where this initial setup goes. Instead of, this isn't about the immortality serum. This isn't about that. It's about the moral convictions or lack thereof of all of these people.
Yeah. Can I make a small point about the blood oath?
Yes.
Which...
The Shankar.
Yeah. Just a little headcanon that she literally can smell her.
I mean, they do have good sense of smell.
Like, in my head, she's very literal when she's like, I could sniff her out. Like, she's burned into my brain. I could sniff her out. For some reason, I just like the idea that the Narn have that inane sense.
They are very animalistic in comparison to the other races in that manner. I mean, she's from a brood. Let's never forget that great line.
I also like that Jakar was like, hey, listen, we've all got Shankars. I've got like a bunch of them.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I got stacks.
What's going on there, Jakar? What are all these like vengeance blood oaths that you've sworn?
He just does it for fun. When he's bored, he goes out on the town. He just makes blood oaths with strangers. I like the point that you're making earlier about how this episode does start with a very simple moral question and it blossoms into a very realistic portrayal of how that would go on Babylon 5. So, like, let's compare this to real life. If one day you were at your job and you found out that Adolf Hitler was alive and you had the opportunity to kill him. A lot of people probably would do that. But then it's complicated by, like, what if he had the cure to every disease? What if he had the cure to cancer and COVID and everything? But you had to keep him alive and you also had to, like, elevate him to a position of power. Would you do it? And then it's, so it becomes that question. But also, every government is going to want a say in this. You don't just get to be the individual actors who decide on that. You have the Drazi negotiator. You have all these different people being like, Sinclair, you don't get to make this decision. And neither does Natat. That's not fair. This is too much power for two people to handle. She doesn't get to get off on trying to kill this woman. And you don't get to decide that we give her to Earth. Everybody wants to say we are the actor who decides what happens with immortality. Like when... Hitoshi, I think his name is, calls Sinclair and he's like, dog, obviously you give her to us. That's, don't even question that. Yeah, done. Obviously. Close call.
Smiles. Goodbye.
Like, you don't need to know.
Yeah, Senator Hitoshi, this is his first appearance, I'm pretty sure. He was a recurring senator that he had to face off against, and then he exited the show in a line of dialogue in which it's like, Senator Hitoshi has been arrested for sedition. It's like, oh.
Yeah.
Whoopsie.
My man.
So I think it's interesting, though, that, yeah, this blossoms into not just a moral and ethical question, but it does blossom into this diplomatic fiasco, because all of these people want justice until they find out what's being offered. And then they change their mind rather quickly on that. And it's like, what's, like... How does that make you feel? Like, that this type of show is putting that kind of, you know, horrific, bleak, cynical look at how the human society itself works, because obviously that's reflecting back at us. How does that feel? Like, this show's propositioning, like, yeah, we say we want moralities and ethics and justice, but when presented with the benefits to... have more power and to be stronger than we are, we'll take that.
It's interesting. It's so interesting to see the way that they deal with it, of like, is the glory of the prize worth it?
Yeah.
And I like the way that they grapple with it in different ways, because every kind of alien race has a different reaction to it. And I really appreciate the point where they do introduce, when she explains the consequences, like, this can't be synthesized. It, like, the billions that live will cost billions of lives.
Yeah.
And it's just such a juicy concept.
It makes, it's weird to say this, but it reassures me, because I watch stuff like Star Trek for escapism, to be like, oh, we're going to be happy and we're going to have ideals and we're going to be good and things aren't as bad as they are. And I like that Babylon 5 isn't afraid to bite you and just go, no, 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 though. Like, when given the opportunities, we're not going to be the Star Trek universe, are we? We're going to be this universe. We're going to be the universe that history has shown us to be already. And we're going to get better and we're going to get worse. And that's just the cyclical nature of things. And it reassures me, because I think about that in the real world. I think about that as someone with a Polish heritage. I think about how interestingly weird everything spiraled out to be after the Second World War, you know, the war in which we all kind of think in a way, well, that was the last war in which we knew who the bad guys were and the good guys were, and it was very black and white. Those evil Nazis, we punch them in the face and say, never again, except for when we enlist them to help us with our weapons and technology and to get to the moon and to screw over those damn Soviets, and now the Soviets are the bad guys. And it just... that stuff depresses me. But I'm reassured with a piece of media actually commenting upon it and not kind of brushing it aside for the bleak, apathetic nature the world can bestow upon itself.
I love the way that the conversation with Lanier after the assembly vote.
This is like Lanier's first character scene. Like, he's just been in the show and this is like his first scene and real big scene. And boy, boy, does he deliver. I almost kind of like... got a little teary out of that because I was just like, he's so ashamed of his own people. But again, like all of them, like Sinclair, well, that is just the way it is, isn't it? Magellan, you're a history teacher, right?
Yes.
So how do you feel about Babylon 5's commentary on this type of stuff?
I mean, I think I generally agree with one of the great things about Babylon 5 is that JMS idea that when we go to the stars, we take our problems with us. And I, seeing the way that Jakar engages with this situation in the council chamber where he's like, hey, we'd love to have a trial and we want to host it.
We're impartial.
It'll be totally fine. And there is something like, I don't know what the word is, because it's not like optimistic or pessimistic, I guess realistic, but just seeing that and being able to engage with that within the context of the show and take that into, transfer it to your understanding of like seeing a politician deliver that sort of thing in the real world or whatever. I think that that's useful. And I think that that is a way that the show engages with these real world contexts that's valuable. I think for me, to be honest, in this particular episode, the metaphor breaks down a little bit because we're not talking about it for two reasons. Like, we're not arguing with the entire understanding of what's at stake. Like, it's actually two different moral arguments to say, like, oh, we could have this immortality serum, but we like have to not punish this person for genocide, versus we could have this immortality serum, but we need to do more genocide to produce it. And that's like kind of two different things. And the episode, I think the reveal in the moment is cool, where Deathwalker's like, this is how I take my revenge, by like tricking you all into killing each other. But then we've sort of had all this conversation about like, do we punish this person or not? When it's actually like, I don't know, it's a moral decision that I think a lot more characters would have been like, whoa, never mind. Maybe not.
Yeah, if they had all of the information, if they had would all, have made different decisions.
Well, I see. I walk away with neither of those arguments from the episode necessarily being the prevalent one, but more the overwhelming sense of like, how can you stand by having this moral superiority when you're willing, openly willing to benefit off of genocides, off of the genocides of people that you defeated previously and bestowed yourselves as the hero of the galaxy? There's a lot of World War II references, and I think that's the big debate, the big grandiose philosophical statement that I think is more prevalent than the other two things. I think
Just to challenge that for a second, though, like, there's a difference between Nazi scientists like building nukes versus and building like rockets versus like a panacea that prolongs people's lives and saves us from disease.
But it's still
like
the base. But see, that is just the MacGuffin. It's still, to me, the basic principle of, you have
but I,
people.
I don't think you can hand wave that distinction away. Like, that is a meaningful distinction. It's not just glory. It's like it's lives.
Yeah,
it's
but like, you could. But the same argument lives. Is made with Operation Paperclip's existence too. Oh, we're doing this because we have to get these things. But even the episode says after a certain point, it's not even necessarily about the lives. It's about getting one up on everyone else. That's what is presented. And I think, you know, as someone who looks back at stuff like Operation Paperclip, in which, you know, America enlisted all these Nazis, you have people, you know, the Europeans, and you have people like the non-aligned worlds who throw their hands in the air. It's like, well, weren't you guys the heroes? Weren't you guys the guys who came in and helped us? And now you're using all of this stuff, which, you know, and that's the big debate. Like, that's one of those big life debates, right? Like, how much are you supposed to profit off of and progress from these things? And that is also one of the big ideological things in Babylon 5 with the shadows, the bad guys. Their whole philosophy is her philosophy, which is, destruction, genocide, horrors, it's all worth it because you progress and get better and you get more powerful. And
grow through pain. Yeah.
Grow through pain, grow through destruction. And that is what I walk away with. Like, the immortality stuff, yes, it's important, but I see it as the sci-fi MacGuffin and gimmick to launch us into that thought exercise about our real-world stuff of, well, we walk away from these big things thinking that we're very heroic and very give this ideals of, like, we're the good guys. But when given the opportunity to benefit off of the stuff that the bad guys were doing, we'll do it. Mm-hmm. We'll do it.
Not like us. You will become us. That's my monument, Commander.
Get her the hell off my station.
And I think it's great because it's not just, it's Earth, right? You have the Narn. You know, again, it starts out with a victim of this person, a family member who's a victim of this person, wanting just simple blunt force justice of kill this person. But then, how do the Narns handle it? They handle it by being like, no, no, we were trying to deal with her. We're trying to make a deal with her first, and you kind of fucked this up, Natoth. Now I have to step in and try to make it right. And yet, throughout the whole episode, Jakar's Mr. I'm bestowing moral values. And he's the most, like you said, opaque. He's the most obviously deceitful character. You have Londo, who just doesn't care. He's not really invested in any of this. Again, the Centauri weren't involved, so we don't care. Then you have the Minbari, who their whole thing is, we're nice, and we care so much, but we also aided and abetted and also benefited off of this this war criminal. Like, they had their own they had their own Operation Paperclip, in which they enlisted her and helped fuck Earth in the war. And so everyone's hands are dirty in this, except for the Vorlons, except for not really, because then they come in and say, we'll fix this mess. We'll fix this mess. And so that is the kind of stuff that I get from this. What about you, Alan? What do you think? You know, we've all been talking, but I haven't heard much about what your angle is on all that.
So Ivanova, this is my sort of like philosophical summing up of this arc and what we've been talking about. Ivanova, at one point in the episode, says, justice or immortality, an interesting choice. And I really like that line because it clarifies that the show up until now and going forward is about genuinely difficult moral choices. Things like, do we deserve immortality as a race? Who gets to decide that? What governing body decides how to distribute that? What does each faction deserve? And I think it really works, for example, that I believe her name is Kalika, one of the ambassadors, mm-hmm. who says to Sinclair, if you're not going to give this to us, we're just going to leave the nation. Like, we're not going to be a part of this alliance anymore. Because if it's something as simple as, like, a woman has this, like, special power and you're not going to give us access to it, then how are we supposed to make any of the Babylon Project work?
Yeah.
It's fascinating to me that the Babylon Project is depicted here under Sinclair's rule, at least, as under his leadership, as very fragile, because that's how real political nations are. And that's how, you know, you unite a group of people is through fragile alliances and promises that you often have to break.
Yeah. And as we know, having watched the show, the Babylon Project from the get-go was a failure.
It failed.
it failed. And you can see that here, especially on the rewatch. It really hit me hard that one of the things the Interstellar Alliance does to fix things is to make the non-aligned worlds actual members that actually have their individual votes. Right. Again, the leader of the non-aligned worlds here says a line that's like, you know, you are supposed to be the voice for us who are voiceless. And it's like, well, they're voiceless only because that is how this is structured for whatever reason they've made that to be the case.
When Sinclair's explaining, well, like, that's just the way that the assembly was set up.
Yeah, that's how it's set up.
Like, this is the way that it is of, like, we have control and we get to say that you have a voice, but you don't have control.
Yeah, and control's, like, a big issue, too, because Ivanova also has another moment in the episode in which she says, well, this is just too big for us to handle. Like, she's campaigning for give it to Earth because they're bigger than us. They surely have a better way of handling this. But we know, having seen the show, and we know just from the senator alone, no, they didn't. No, no. Earth Earth don't care about the moral convictions of this. They only care about the political convictions,
no,
the power,
like, well, yeah,
the
they
benefits.
Would, they would have better luck controlling riots that broke out.
Yeah, and it's just the sinister nature of it all. And see, that's the stuff I think what I like about this episode is my gears moving in my head rather than J'adore being like, I've made immortality. What do you think of a society that will have immortality? It's not necessarily the future of what that would bestow, but the current climate that it is bringing, the chaos that it is already bringing, and already bringing, just her existence is already bringing, the death walker that she is.
Hell of an irony, don't you think? We find a reason to keep J'adore alive and the Vorlons smoke her for the same reason.
You think it'll always be like this, Michael? Little powers at the mercy of bigger powers, politics before morality, expediency before justice.
Seems to work for everybody, except you. Maybe that's why I like you.
We've got to talk about the weirdest B-plot that Babylon 5 has ever put in an episode.
Rachel, tell me about the VCRs.
Rachel, tell me about the VCR.
Tell us about the Vickers.
Well, who's it's an also... old Earth technology.
where do you begin?
Okay, so this episode actually opens with Talia.
I will say it's one of the most iconic, like, not just that, but also Natoth. The cold open of this, to me, is one of the most iconic cold opens in
the
fucking show.
But I always forget that the Talia bit comes first, because Natoth just goes off the fucking chain.
With some of the most graphic violence the show put step forth.
Like, she's like, just like, where's a fucking weapon?
Kill, kill, kill. Yeah.
And I do just want to note that I particularly enjoy picking out random actors in the background that are done up in alien makeup.
Looking confused and scared.
There's a Minbari that's in these weird sort of like half overalls.
He's a worker cast.
Yeah. but he's in the background of a couple of scenes, including like watching Natoth beat the shit
out
of Deathwalker. But we're meant to be talking about Talia.
Yeah.
So Talia gets hired by Kosh.
I love that she gets hired. Like, she rejects it being like, well, no, you need to do, like, paperwork. And I love that Babylon 5 focuses on details like that. Like, the idea that the Vorlons,
like, you can't
did
just
the
say,
paperwork and
you,
paid her with money.
You can't just say that you hire me and then I go read somebody's mind. There's bureaucracy to this
and,
shit.
And Kosh being like, I'm an old alien god. I know about bureaucracy, let me
Come
tell you.
Come on. and then we get...
The Hour of Scampering, one of the lines that I think of with Kosh.
Yeah. And Talia Winter's like, what is that, 7 o'clock? Like, I need a consistent time.
The Hour of Scampering is when I want to go get a drink of water, but it's 2 a.m. and I don't want to like be too awake or wake anyone up. And I have to run to the
side.
You
get scared of the darkness in the hallway, so you run really fast.
Exactly, yeah. And then there's a noise, and then I cry, and I sleep in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm. And when's your Hour of Longing?
My Hour of Longing is when I wait for this podcast to start.
Oh, there you go. There we go. Wait for
That's
the start.
Nice. Nice sentiment.
I don't know what to say. Remember, I was stuck with this for 7 years. I was stuck with this for so long that I was like, fuck all the other mysteries. This has got to be important, right? Like, what is this? What the fuck is this?
Because how do the Vorlons measure time?
No, just the whole story. The B-plot. Because here's the thing.
What is the Hour of Scampering?
The Hour of Longing. When is this?
What are the other hours?
I can't tell. It's always night and space.
What other hours are there? How many are there? But like, I like many people... was fascinated by Kosh, because Kosh was the mystery character. We didn't know what he looked like. Mm-hmm. We didn't even know if it was the real, like, if it was the same Kosh in each episode. We didn't know anything. He talked gibberish nonsense that was like, you knew it was foreshadowing to things, and you knew it was saying something, but you didn't know what it was. So it was like, in this episode, he's literally talking like garbage for a lot of it, like just pure nonsense. Yeah. And I remember being like, well, at least I got Kosh, and I always think of the iconic line from Garibaldi,
well, Kosh has been, you know, that Kosh has been a busy boy today. This is the episode where Kosh is very busy doing things.
Been a busy boy.
It's like his plot is him being busy in the way that Kosh would be busy, which is nonsense to the audience currently. what do you guys think? Because I remember listening to your podcast and you guys are like, well, this will be one that will be better when we revisit it years later.
Excuse me, Ryan. I haven't actually got to explain the concept of VCR.
Oh, sorry.
Come on. Online. Let the fucking host of the show
we're on
do
the
it.
Edges of our seats.
All I've been doing here is listening to Rachel. I have you muted, Ryan. Come on. Go ahead. Please explain it to us.
Sheesh.
Go ahead.
Talia is mentally tortured, essentially, by Kosh.
Yeah.
And that's the entire purpose of the business arrangement.
And the vicar is? Mm-hmm. He's a guy?
Yes.
Part
weird guy.
Part
yes, so he's
my man!
cybernetic. He's part humanoid, part machine.
Mm.
And he can basically record anything.
Anything?
Yep.
Oh, anything.
Anything.
Including your mind.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Including your thought patterns.
That's interesting.
So it's basically there so that they have dirt on Talia for a later storyline that doesn't happen because the actress left the show.
Well, it does happen, but the payoff doesn't happen. This payoff doesn't happen. Yeah. That story happens, but the payoff doesn't happen in that way. Yes, yes.
Wait, so what were they planning
for? So here's what this is. Talia, for those who don't remember or need a refresher, has a secret double personality from the Psycorp put in her brain. And the notion was Kosh is using this to basically map out her original personality or to be able to awaken her original personality when she's flipped to being controlled fully. So basically, Kosh has the ability to bring Talia back on a USB. And then it would have been like further meddling and interferences that the Vorlons would put upon her that you eventually do see happen with Leta Alexander. And that's where this would have gone. But the actress left the show because she wasn't getting enough and she was divorcing Jerry Doyle and numerous other reasons, I imagine. So this lingers as
She was with Jerry Doyle?
I thought she was with J. Michael Straczynski.
No. Talia, I'm talking about.
Oh. Right.
Talia left the show, and so this storyline exists, but it also doesn't.
I'd say you were set up.
But why?
The Vorlons are leery of telepaths. If Kosh knows what you fear the most, he can use it against you in the future.
For what?
With the Vorlons, who knows?
But how was it for you guys coming back and rewatching this storyline, especially also knowing what Kosh is as a character? Because when you watched it the first time, Kosh is just a mystery. Now, when you rewatch it, you're like, oh, I know Kosh. I know what he's about.
Yeah, I think for me, what I liked about revisiting an old episode with what I know about Kosh later is being able to see Kosh as like, an operative. Like he's not this like super mysterious unknowable guy. He's a Vorlon who's like
he's working for a system like everyone else. Vorlons...
Yeah.
Right. He's as much an ambassador as the other ambassadors, and just like Londo or Jakar or whoever, he's making practical choices. He's preparing for things. He's trying to benefit his particular race, and you can kind of enjoy him as like just a dude. It's just Kosh.
Yeah.
He's I don't know what he's doing, but he's putting, like you're saying, Talia Winters on a hard drive just in case, because he might need
for
to
the future.
Have that
for the future
for later. Mm-hmm. And it's just fun to like, even though this doesn't really go anywhere, that I think that alone is useful, and it's also just fun to see Kosh hang out with a guy who like just has a big brain, and that's just like who Kosh hangs out
also
with.
Also to hang out with Talia, because Talia is like the most meek character outside of Via and Linnea to throw at him. So it's very interesting to see that too. Like, what a weird pairing. I wouldn't have put that on my bingo card.
I love the way that she phrases it. I was like, I think I'm having a problem with Ambassador Cox.
Yeah.
Like, don't she's we all? Like, I don't know what just happened, but I think I don't like it.
Yeah. There's a couple, like, random Kosh lines that are just random in those conversations. And then there's a couple great ones. I mean, understanding is a three-edged sword is, like, you know,
iconic.
We know that one. Iconic. The two I really liked, there was this moment where Talia was like, what do you need this for? What do you need me for? And Kosh says, what is need compared to the plan? Which is like the most Vorlon thing to
say. It's the most direct thing.
Yeah, he's just like, I don't need stuff. I do what I have been told, because that's what Vorlons
need
think.
Doesn't matter. Obedience is what matters. Just do the things that I need you to fucking do.
Yeah. And then the other line that is also iconic in its way that helped me to kind of reframe how I thought about this episode, actually, is when Kosh says, ah, you seek meaning, then listen to the music, not the song.
Yeah.
It's like, you don't need to think about this episode, because this episode it's dumb. But there's music, there's themes, baby.
Yeah.
Come on.
You seek meaning.
Yes.
Then listen to the music, not the song.
So something I talk about a lot on the podcast is I'm always frustrated by people who, you know, fans who desperately seek explicit answers and who somehow think that, and who were raised on television that gave them stuff like that, or media that gave them clear answers. And so they think, okay, all television needs to give me this, or it's, quote, bad TV or bad sci-fi. And Kosh is, like, such a refutation of that, because the answer is so much less interesting than, like, the vibe around it. Exactly like he's saying, like, listen to the music. Like, there are things for you to think about that do not have to tie into a greater lore with the Vorlons. Like, yeah, what the Vorlons end up being is really cool and interesting, and what he's doing with Tali here. But, like, this is the magic of TV, y'all, is, like, we are able to piece together an interesting Vorlon, like, thematic plot here, even though, as you said, Ryan, like, this doesn't amount to anything in the actual show, because a lot of it was changed because of casting, because TV is, like, a live medium that evolves in a real-life environment. It's not, like, yeah, even Babylon 5, a show that was much more laid out from the beginning than a lot of other television, still has, like, you know, obviously the most famous one being Sinclair being switched to Sheridan. Like, things in real life affect the story. And so, like, expecting this Talia plot to, like, and maybe I'm also teasing past Alan for thinking this, but, like, expecting it to have a clear, definitive, like, here's why she's seeing these visions, doesn't take into account the fact that, like, TV is malleable. It's really interesting, and I think that's what I end up liking about Kosh in general, is a lot of times you're like, oh, if I'm going to go back and rewatch Babylon 5 and, like, answer all of the things that Kosh says, and I'm going to know what they all mean now. And it's like, dog, sometimes he's just being weird. Like, sometimes he's just like,
it is true.
I am testing you, because it's just, I test people. That's what I do.
Yeah, but in all fairness, too, yes, things are malleable, but you still want that sense of satisfaction that things made sense, and when you revisit it, things are consistent. And although this plot doesn't amount to anything, his character is consistent and was always consistent, and that's what's important. You look back and there are, let's say, like, we're rewatching it, 90% of his lines you go and nod at and go, yep, I know what you're saying, because I know you. I know you. At this point in the show, we didn't know Kosh. That was the point. You didn't know Kosh. He abstained from everything. And when he did enter, he was weird and didn't make sense. And you didn't know what the jigsaw puzzle was supposed to be. And then you zoom out and you get to find out. And you're like, oh, yeah, of course. Rachel, you wanted to touch upon something?
Yeah, I find it really interesting. Like, this is what, our, like, third or fourth rewatch of Babylon 5?
Mm-hmm.
And
you and I together, yeah.
Yeah. And I just find it odd, and I really appreciate that with the journey that we go on with Kosh and the Vorlons, now I appreciate, like, the hour of scampering just as much as the reveal of what he actually looks like.
Yeah.
And both of those moments are really important to understanding Kosh.
Yeah, one's comedic and one's, like, essential, but they both tie through with what the character's about. The esoteric actually has sense to it. It isn't just there to be weird. Like, the big line, obviously, to get to is, like, Kosh has, you know, enters the A-plot at the end, and he's, and it's like a big surprise. They're like, you're entering the A-plot? And he's like, dude, I was always in the A-plot.
Yeah. I am the A-plot. And,
like, he wouldn't be there to watch their reactions is my feeling.
Yeah.
But, like, he didn't want to stay in his quarters.
Not just that.
He walks in, like, just as it's about to happen.
Well, he walks in like a parent. He's just like, I walk in and teach you the lesson. You do not get immortality. I decide what happens. Naughty. Bad. Don't do that. I'm your parent. Which, again, is one of those things when you watch for the first time, you just go, oh, the Deus Ex Machina came in, and Kosh is the Vorlon. They're always powerful. They're always mysterious, and everyone's going to let them do it because they're frightened of them and they don't know what they're capable of. But when you rewatch the show and you know that their whole ideology and why they do the things they do, you look at that moment and you go, yeah. Yeah, that's of course what you would do, Kosh. Of course,
like,
you do that. You do
no
you, man.
No way that the Vorlons would let them get immortality.
No, and especially with, like, such a brutal way of doing it, but not even that. Like, you know.
Oh, I don't even think that they care about that.
Well, you
as
don't
much.
Know. Well, that's the thing that's great about the plot is it makes it seem like Kosh, as always in this part of the story, is removed entirely from the A-plot. Like every now and then they'll be like, where's Kosh? And he's like, oh, Kosh doesn't give a shit. But then Kosh comes in and it's like, no. Kosh has been paying attention to this whole situation the entire time and made a decision that, again, shows what a failure Babylon 5 is. Because Sinclair thinks, okay, I've managed to wrestle all of these differing factions and I've figured out a solution that makes everyone happy. Maybe peace, maybe cooperation is possible. And then the old god walks in the room and says, no, my way is possible. Yours is stupid. Peace is irrelevant.
I am in charge.
Yeah, peace, cooperation is irrelevant. Immortality is not for you. You have to fall into place the way that we have designed you to fall into place.
The plan.
The great plan, as people say. What do you guys think about all of that stuff when you're looking back at it?
Well, I think something to say about Kosh as a character, like, Kosh is a Vorlon and is making a bunch of choices and doing things that a Vorlon would do because he's bought into the Vorlon mission. And also, Kosh is distinct from other Vorlons that we meet later in the sense that Kosh is, like, willing, when Tali Winters asks a question, to stop, turn around, and give an answer, even if that answer is, like, cryptic and not helpful to her. He's here to say something, and that says something about, like, who he is or what he believes should be the relationship between Vorlons and these other species. And when we're laughing at him walking in the room at the end because, like, he doesn't have to be there. But also that's significant. Like, he doesn't have to be there. Maybe there's, like, this Vorlon directive of, like, you need to deliver the moral. But maybe that's also coming from Kosh of, like, he feels like it would be a good thing. It would help them to deliver this moral message in some way. And that kind of, like, again, things that rhyme with other things later, ultimately, like, Kosh's downfall being his willingness to kind of overstep the particular bounds of his role for the sake of the folks around him. And I think that is a moment that carries more weight than I could have ever possibly known that it did at the time.
Yeah.
Because at the time it's just like, oh, the toilet man is in here to tell us that we did a bad job.
To explain
something.
Why he's the Deus Ex Machina, basically. And I think it's interesting, too, like, to slightly counter you, in the show thus far, he does just stop talking to people. Like Sinclair asks him a question, and then he like, his eye closes, and he powers down, and he waits for him to leave. But with Talia, he's open and free the whole time, and you have to remember he's helping Talia in a way that he's not helping anyone else. And then you remember, oh, that's right, the Vorlons have, like, they mention it, they have a weird relationship with telepaths. Which we find out why that's the case later, which is because they made them and they feel more of a responsibility or an ownership a definite ownership of having done that. These are their weapons, not the Shadow's weapons, not Psycor's weapons. These are their weapons, their children, in a way that is different to just Sinclair. Like, Sinclair can sit there and be like, help us, and he's like, nah, I'm not gonna do that. But then Talia, please explain. I'll try, my child. I'll try, but I'm not gonna help you very much. Alan, how does it feel to you know, with Kosh and the end line and all this stuff, like, anything you want to bounce off of there?
Well, no, not really. Magellan said a lot of things really smartly there. And yeah, I think it's challenging. Like I said at the very top here, knowing where this is going makes it a lot better. But also in the moment, I trusted this show and understood that, like, I'm sure I will appreciate this more down the line. Whether, like, I even right now I'm remembering the telepath thing because you mentioned it. I'm like, wow, that is really cool. And I'm remembering the control stuff, but I just remember watching it and being like, I need to decipher these visions. Because, again, I came from that school of television criticism of, like, you got to answer things. And, yeah, I like it a lot more now. I think I've turned around on this episode and this plot line in particular and come to like it.
Master Kosh has been a busy boy today.
They say God works in mysterious ways.
Maybe so. But he's a con man compared to the Vorlon.
I think we're ready to do our actor spotlight. The part of the show in which we talk about an actor that was in this episode of Babylon 5. Talk about what we thought of their performance, what we've seen them in before, and any interesting facts about them. Of course, we have to talk about Deathwalker herself. I mean, Mr. Abbott was an obvious choice as well. I was also tempted to give the Fish Lady Ambassador a go because she is played by Robin Curtis, who played Savick in Star Trek 3 and 4. So that's something to note down, but I think we have to talk about...
We could have done it about who was supposed to be Mr. Abbott.
Also. Oh, Gilbert Gottfried. The boldest casting choice the show would have made outside of Bryan Cranston. Yeah. But think it's time to talk about Sarah Douglas. Rachel, you've watched this episode multiple times. Mm-hmm. What do you think about her in this episode?
I think she nails it. I think it's very clear that she knows who she is. Mm. And I particularly appreciate the way that her body language communicates this ease that she has because she feels dominant and superior to everybody else that's in a room.
And confident.
So she doesn't need to pretend to be big. She just stands there and she is strong.
She moves because of the makeup too. She has a very angular way of moving, like a cat does. Like, I think of her leaping out of the bed when she's waking up and seeing Franklin fucking around with her serum. And she kind of, you know, glides over there. And I think that's kind of interesting. I really like her performance. She's one of the more memorable villains because also she chews up the scenery in a really glorious way. But in a way that... makes sense, like, for what her character is and for what the tone of the episode can be at times, because again, this episode is going on multiple tones, but
it manages to add, not distract.
And as stated, I appreciate that there is no gray with her character. It's very black and white. She's evil. And if she played it like this and she's supposed to be more morally gray, like Giorgio in Discovery, then I would be pissed
Everyone's
off.
Everyone's favorite fascist. Sorry.
Everyone's favorite totalitarian. You know, she's she's pansexual. So, you know, she'll get her own show in which she can pansexual it up all over the galaxy.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that. Like, I also appreciate that the episode allows her just to play it as the villain she is. Because sometimes, you know, you watch these shows and you have a villain that's presented to you as a little bit more nuanced, but you have a cheesy over-the-top performance that kind of feels disingenuous to that because the actor's like, I'm playing a bad guy, all of that. Here, her doing that works because that is the character. The character is, I am the Nazi. There's no gray with that. Like I'm a Nazi, and Nazis were just evil, okay? We're not going to dance around being like, maybe they had good points via her character. You're going to have the other characters debate what she's putting forth, but her performance, no. She's just going to cackle and look evil and be British. Magellan, what do you think about Sarah Douglas's performance as the titular Death Walker?
I mean, yeah, she does a great job. She's got the evil laugh when Jakar leaves that one scene. It works. I think I'm not as like wide open arms about the concept of a character who's just like evil in B5, where like you have other characters who are doing things that are horrible and we like fully understand their complex motivations and flaws and whatever. Like, so I don't know. I'm not like this character rocks, but for what's there, she's fun to watch.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, yeah, that's a bad
guy. But there's plenty of characters that we all love that are just bad guys. Emperor Katarzyna. He's just a bad guy.
Yeah, but you, like, understand why he's bad. Like, you never really get why the Dilgar are bad, except that they like to kill.
Like, I know why she was bad in this context of, like, being the last of her people and the experimentation of, like, all that. That makes sense for her. The Dilgars as a race, we don't get to know, really. Doesn't...
Yeah, where's the Dilgar war lore that I'm looking for? That's what I want to know.
Yeah. What about you, Alan? What do you think of Sarah Douglas's turn here as the Jadur?
I think she gets the job done. I preferred her in the original V, though, where she plays, is it Janet or something? Yeah.
Don't worry, dear Pamela. I'll do my scientific best to command your fleet.
Have any of us actually seen her in anything else when we were looking through her roster of work? Was there anything that popped out? Because she's done a lot of work.
She's only done 89 credits.
Pretty good, though.
It's pretty good, but the majority of actors that we do for this spotlight have at least over 100.
All right, let's not have a pissing contest with her.
No, let's have a pissing contest.
You invited that,
Ryan. Stratford upon Avon.
Okay. Zorro Gen Z, the animated series.
Yeah.
Wait.
But Rachel.
Oh, Gen Z because Zorro. Go ahead.
Have you seen her in anything else?
Yeah, I have. I've watched the trash that is the Christmas Prince movies.
Of course.
Yeah.
And she's essentially the evil housekeeper.
Wait, whoa, 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 whoa. Hold the presses. Evil?
Yeah, she's an antagonist to the protagonist because
I can't believe Sarah would play a role like that.
I know. She doesn't approve of our character and her blog. She deletes blog posts and shames her.
She's okay. Also a Kryptonian on Superman the Animated Series named Mala.
And she's also the female Kryptonian in General Zod's gang in the Superman movies.
Ursa.
Ursa.
Oh, okay. I've seen Superman 2. Yeah. The one with the...
She also appears in Supergirl.
Yeah. One of the sad trivia facts that I like burns me up inside is she wanted to be on Smallville and they just didn't give her an invitation. They just didn't bother.
Same.
That
sucks because it's like they got other people from the Superman movies and whatever, but they just didn't get her, which is kind of weird because, like you said, she was still doing Superman material. She's still currently doing Superman material. It's kind of like, okay, Smallville.
She's done a fair chunk of sci-fi.
Of course. That's her wheelhouse. I wonder what it is with certain actors like this, because I also look up her career. She's done a lot of sci-fi, but she's also done like a lot of like traditional like English stuff, and I wonder what it is about these traditional Englishy actors wanting to be in weirdo makeup and sci-fi.
Her first credit, I think, was like ITV Saturday Theatre.
Yeah, it's exactly. Like,
oh my, of course it is.
Yeah, Magellan, what about you? Anything Sarah Douglas has been in that you're like, oh, she's in that thing?
No, I was looking, but I didn't see
Solitary
anything.
Tear rolls down the cheek. I don't know. She seems like I said this to you, Rachel. She seems like a pretty interesting person. Like, I read a little bit about her, and she has a commentary track that I really want to listen to. She was in Conan the Destroyer, which is a sequel that is terrible to Conan the Barbarian. And apparently, like, from what I can understand, she's the only one that's on the commentary track. And she spends the time just talking about her career and her life. and the movie.
She does a solo commentary track?
I think so, from what I can gather. I don't have it in, I don't actually have it, so I can't guarantee incredible. That. But she's like a villain in that movie. Who would have guessed?
And the best thing about Conan the Destroyer is Grace Jones. Thank you.
And so Sarah Douglas agrees, because Sarah Douglas did the movie because she's a fan of Grace Jones. And then
how
now they're close and now they're best friends or close friends because they worked on that movie.
Oh.
Imagine being friends with Leo. Imagine being friends with Grace Jones because you did Conan the Destroyer. What an interesting life being led. But I do want to share one fun fact that's really bizarre. She was in this movie called Tommy, which is the film adaptation of the album by The Who. And she was cast in a role, and she had to fly all the way back to England. And she was removed from the movie because the director didn't like the hat she was given to wear.
Yeah. Oh,
and so instead of replacing the hat, he replaced the actress. All of this you can hear in the Conan the Destroyer commentary track for some fucking reason. Like, I'm a big fan of weird commentary tracks, and I want to really listen to this one. I just want to hear this woman be like, look, I did Conan the Destroyer because I like Grace Jones. We're best friends. We go, you know, clubbing. And also, I was in Tommy, but I wasn't. Also, I was in this movie, but I wasn't. And here's why, these fucking producers. Like, that's a power move. I would love to do that power move. If I was an actor and I was giving a commentary track, I would do that. I'd be like, all right, the movie, whatever. Let's talk about my career, though.
You're doing a lot of evil ladies now.
Yes, I just suck in my cheeks and flash my eyes and they pay me. It's wonderful.
Our ratings on here go via Yum being bad and Yum Yum being good. It's very good or bad. There's no in between. There's no half yums. There's no yum and a half. There's
I know, baby. There's no half yums in this studio department.
No.
Sorry, I just woke up. I'm just kidding. I'm completely kidding.
Rachel, where do you land? Death Walker, yum or yum yum?
Yum yum.
Yum yum.
I didn't really have any real issues with this. I think this is structurally one of the tighter scripts we've done thus far on the rewatch. I didn't really feel like there was any odd moments that didn't need to be there, even though the B-plot is odd.
If anything, I wish that there was kind of more time.
Yeah, I guess so. But, like, I felt like the stakes were done well, so I give it a yum-yum.
Yum-yum.
Alan, yum or yum-yum? You've already done this rodeo before, so you know where it goes.
Oh, you know I do, baby. And this is a yum-yum from me.
Yum-yum.
Magellan, we're going to pop your yum or yum-yum cherry now. Where do you land on Death Walker?
Oh, goodness gracious. You know, I think what really pushes this episode over the edge is there's a moment where Jadur says to Sinclair, quote, "They say you have a hole in your mind," which was awesome to me because that's so stupid. Anyway, that's why I give this one a nice lean pastrami with just a little mustard out of yum, which is a yum yum.
Yum yum.
Play.
Hello, old friend. It's been a while.
I got an email here from our good pal, all of our good pal, Nick. And Nick has decided that he's going to skewer both of our buttholes.
Here we go.
He has a real email here called reply chatsalon5/deathwalker. Not even to our own show, Rachel, to these guys. So he has this to say. Listened again to the Chatsalon 5 discussion of this episode. And since I wasn't a regular listener at the time, I had to wait for this moment to tell you all what I think. Though obviously this is a mix for Yum Yum and Chats Pod. Thanks, Nick. I'm glad he clarified that he's including us in this too, Rachel. I'm not going to claim that it was a great episode, but as far as TV sci-fi, I think it was a pretty well put together story. It was well written by Larry DiTilio, who is one of those guys who wrote on a lot of TV science fiction shows. I know Alan has listened to the JMS autobiography, so you know he was a long-time writing partner of JMS. And I think as much as we like to praise JMS for his Season 2 to Season 5 97% solo writing credits, Larry is one of the better...
Unreal.
Yeah, Larry is one of the better Season 1 writers. I want to agree, but I'm pretty sure Larry wrote... I have to double-check, but I'm pretty sure he wrote TKO. So...
Yes.
TKO was a failed idea from the start.
No,
you can't entirely blame him.
No, but if he came up with it, then I can.
Yeah, so, yeah. So, if it was his idea, entirely default. Fuck him.
So Nick goes on to give us some further clarification. He goes, "While yes, you can assume nobody we know would become immortal by the end of the episode, an interesting trivia bit was that apparently the script notes had either this serum or the healing device as ideas to be used to revive Garibaldi in season 2. Think about it. We almost had an immortal Garibaldi."
Okay.
So the show isn't afraid to use these ideas, just only had room for one. Or did we want an immortal Susan Ivanova to live forever without boffing Marcus? Yes. Can we ignore that short story forever, please? where Marcus is revived and he makes a clone. Can we ignore that?
I forgot about that. Oh, God.
Here's a question. He has a couple of questions for us. Of all the races, which do you think was the most willing to kill off half or the other half to live? So basically, who do you think was the most willing to massacre people for the immortality serum? Mine's the Narn. I think it's the Narn. Rachel, the Narn or who?
Yeah, it's the Narn.
Majan, what do you think? Who's the most willing?
Humans. The humans. Earth is terrible.
So you're putting
humans
Earth first, huh?
The United States.
Oh, wow. We got a Home Guard agent putting Earth first.
Whoa.
Cuff him. Okay, hold on. I'm a Mars resistance forever, please.
Oh, so you're a Marzi. Okay, fine. Like our good pal Jeff Sinclair, you're a Marzi.
yes.
Exactly. Alan, where do you land?
The Centauri.
Hmm. The bold call here, the Centauri. Nobody wants to say the Minbari, though, because, you know...
They had the chance.
They had the chance, kinda. And Nick also says, would the warrior caste look to use this against the religious caste? Maybe, Nick. I don't know if the warrior... Maybe. The warrior caste are kind of pricks. Okay, now Nick has a comment about the VCRs as well. If a VCR becomes a vicar, then what is a DVD or Blu-ray? It's a big question.
David?
Well, their son? Sheridan's son, David?
Yeah, he's a DVD.
Barry?
And some blue guy called Ray is one of
Blaine. Blarney. Sorry, I'm having fun here.
Blarney.
Now, Nick also has to say, how does the Abbott plot work for us knowing? Now, we've already kind of gone through this, Nick. Unfortunately, in the discussion, we've already kind of said what we think about this Abbott plot. It's weird. It kind of lingers. It just doesn't work. And he has to say, and lastly, I'm surprised the furries didn't love this episode due to the cat lady makeup.
Nick, doesn't go far enough.
There's better furry content later in the show. Come
yeah,
on,
like the Pac-Mara. Yeah.
Exactly like the Pac-Mara.
It's not a hump.
You could have literally said the Flibgorp and I would have been like, exactly like the Flibgorp.
You don't remember our boys, the Pac-Mara with the little squid faces?
Oh, I remember the Pac-Mara.
Everyone remembers the Pac-Mara. How could we forget?
The Carrion Eaters.
The Carrion Eaters. And Nick chastises us at the end for recording ahead so far. Nick, we've got guests and September when we record this is a very, very busy time. So if you want episodes to come out every week, we're going to have to record a couple ahead. Soz Buzz Lightyear.
We're not recording to ahead. It's today's date right now.
Today's date, 1993.
Yeah. This is my favorite day of the week. It's
insert Tuesday. Name here.
Here you go. I'll give you a take of each one. It's Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, it's Saturday. There you go.
I'm a little disappointed that you don't know what day our episode comes out.
Yeah.
Well, no, we're just giving you insurance.
Reflection, surprise, terror for the future.
We are going to have to move on and hear about what we're going to be talking about next time on Babylon 5.
On the next Babylon 5.
Episode 10, Believers. Medicine versus faith. And Sinclair must decide. The station's final...
Oh, that one's so good.
I thought we were skipping this episode, right?
No, we're doing this episode because we're not a pussy podcast. We do all the episodes.
Wow, why not? The station's vital neutrality policy is at risk if Medical Chief Franklin performs an operation to save a child, but violates the ancient alien religion of the child's parents. I love this episode.
Yeah, and that's why we
loved
this
one. Yeah,
it's great.
Well,
it's great.
We'll see how it holds up on our rewatch next time.
On an idea level, it is great.
People better get themselves ready for that one to be discussed next episode. You better believe in the egg, or else you are not going to benefit from that episode. If you're not a believer of the egg, and, well, need I say more? Need I say more?
Franklin's the Eggman. Cuckoo.
There you go.
So that's it from us for this one. Chats, where can people find you and your podcast?
The easiest way to find us right now is to go to your podcast player of choice and search our current name, Peaks Chats, with the chats is spelled C-H-A-T-Z, colon, a Twin Peaks podcast. That's our current name. Most of the time, the name of the show is Chats, a Television Podcast. You can also go to chatspod.simplecast.com. You can follow us on Twitter at chatspod. You can go to our website, chatspod.com. You can go to the Patreon, patreon.com/chatspod. We're chatspod everywhere that we could be that. And then the name of the show right now, the name of the place,
the name of the pod,
Peaks Chats, currently. Yeah.
It failed. No, I'm just kidding.
it's a dream given form. Come on, it's a dream given form.
It is full of miscreants, nomads, and losers.
Disgusting people.
Entrepreneurs and wanderers. Entrepreneurs shows a picture of McGrath.
Yep.
Sinclair's intro is the best one.
Yeah. Oh, Vonnegut. Rachel, tell everyone where we can be found on the internet.
We are on the various social medias as Yum Yum Pod or Yum Yum Podcast, but if you want to skip that process of trying to figure out which one's where, just go to that description and they're all linked for you, including a link to our wonderful Patreon where you can get even more content from us.
Yeah, we talk about Star Trek's best and worst rated episodes. We talk about the movies. We give our thoughts on random things, other television shows, other podcasts. Movies in general as well, games occasionally. So Patreon's where things are happening. Things are popping off on the Patreon, so make sure to check that all out. Please feel free to rate and review us on whatever podcatcher you use. It'll be greatly appreciated. I'm still waiting.
Yum Yum reviews are only allowed, which like has to be converted to a 5-star rating system.
Yeah, I had a phone call with the president, and he, the president told me, Ryan, we're trying to get all the podcatchers to convert to the Yum Yum rating system, but it's just that, hands are tied. It's just really difficult. I feel bad, but I'm trying my best. And I slammed my fist on the table and said, this isn't good enough. Have you given us a review, Mr. President? I don't think so. Have the chats given us a review? I don't know. I have to double check. I don't see Big Daddy M reviewing us, so I don't think Magellan's given us a review on
that. That is my username everywhere. Yeah.
That's his username everywhere, Big Daddy M. And
That's his personal Twitter.
That's his personal life.
His OnlyFans as well.
That's it, people. We like to wrap out by giving each other the iconic farewell that Jakar bestowed in the pilot movie that he never did again. Chats, Rachel, good eating to you.
Good eating to you.
Thank you.
There's a hole in your mind.
There's a hole in your butt.
Oh, I know.
Okay. I really appreciate that on rewatch.
Ah, Mystic.